In the preceding lecture, I stated that there are two sources from which we may derive our knowledge of theology, reason, and revelation. Reason signifies the intellectual powers of man exercised without supernatural assistance in the investigation of religious truth. I have endeavored to ascertain what is the amount of its discoveries, and it has appeared that the streams which flow from this source are neither clear nor copious. I shall not now recapitulate what was said, as there will be an opportunity to revert to it in a subsequent part of the lecture. Let us proceed to speak of the other source of theology, namely divine revelation. I begin with a definition of the term. Revelation signifies information supernaturally communicated, and according to this general definition, it comprehends not only the discovery of truths which lay beyond the range of reason, but the publication with new evidence and luster of such truths as are within its reach, but of which, in its present corrupt state, it had not been able to form distinct conceptions. The first remark which I make is that a revelation is possible. There is no reason to doubt that he who had imparted to man a certain degree of light by endowing him with intellectual powers might impart to him a higher degree by some other means. In doing so, he would only act the same part with a person of superior talents and acquirements, who should make known to his pupils by oral instruction certain recondite truths which their utmost efforts could not have discovered. The subject may be illustrated by another comparison. Revelation is to the mind what a glass is to the eye. Whether it be intended to correct some accidental defect in its structure, or to extend its power of vision beyond its natural limits, God, when he gave understanding to man, did not exert himself to the utmost of his power. Nor did he come under an obligation never to enlarge this faculty, or to furnish it with extraordinary assistance. If man should sustain any injury in the intellectual part of his nature, there was nothing to hinder his benevolent Creator from repairing it. Nor, if he should be brought into such circumstances that new knowledge was needed, was there any physical or moral cause which could prevent him from affording it. Revelation does not imply a reflection upon the original work of God, as if he had made man an intelligent creature, but afterwards found that the degree of intelligence was not adequate to the purposes of his being. The most zealous advocates for revelation maintain that reason, in its pure state, was perfectly sufficient for all the ends which it was intended to accomplish, and that the necessity of revelation arises from a new state of things, superinduced by man himself. He now needs more light, and it is the business of revelation to impart that light. All reasoning, the object of which is to establish the prior impossibility of a revelation, is manifestly absurd. But attempts have been made to prove this point by arguments of a different kind. Doubts have been raised whether a revelation could be made, because it does not appear how a person could be certain that it was a genuine revelation, and not a dream or an illusion of fancy. Enthusiasts, it has been said, who are prompted only by a wild imagination, and persons in a frenzy, or the raving fit of a fever, are as fully satisfied of the reality of the things presented to them, and convinced of the truth and soundness of their own notions, as those are whose senses are clear and perfect, and whose reason is in its full vigor. On this ground it has been represented as not easy to conceive how the prophets and apostles, as we call them, could have been so confident as they were that God had in reality made any revelation to them. But this argument is so foolish that it may seem equally foolish to give a serious answer to it. What is the amount of it? It is this, that there is much imposture in the world, and therefore there is no truth, that many persons are deceived, and therefore no man can know that he is in the right. To what purpose tell us of the dreams of enthusiasts, or of men laboring under fever or lunacy? We are speaking of persons in the full possession of their senses, for those to whom divine communications were made, although powerfully impressed and strongly excited to act under their impulse, were not agitated like the priests of Baal or the Pythoness of Delphi, but retained the calm exercise of their faculties, and were able to distinguish among their thoughts those which could be traced to a natural cause, and those which proceeded from a higher source. Besides, the objection is founded on a supposition, than which one more absurd cannot be conceived, that although God might make a communication to the mind of an individual, he could not convince that individual that it was a communication from himself. He could infuse ideas into his mind, but he could not enable him to discern whether they were true or false, whether there was anything real in them, or they were the shadowy creations of fancy. A man can assure his correspondent that the message which he receives comes from him, and not from another. But God, it seems, possesses no means of authenticating his declarations. It must forever remain uncertain whether they are the dictates of infinite wisdom or the offspring of a disordered brain. the man who should think there is any force or even any degree of plausibility in this argument against the possibility of a revelation may be justly considered as destitute of common sense. I can hardly believe that any infidel was ever so stupid as to lay any stress upon it, and am disposed to suspect that it may be referred rather to the malice than to the cool judgment of those by whom it has been retained. We indeed cannot tell how inspired men distinguished by divine communications from the suggestions of their own minds, for this obvious reason, that they have not informed us, and we have not experienced such communications. But our ignorance ought not to be opposed to their knowledge, and to the unquestionable fact that God could stamp upon his communications infallible signatures of truth. But although a person to whom a divine communication was made might be fully assured of the source from which it came, it has been objected that the assurance must remain with himself, as there are no means by which he can produce a similar conviction in others. To this argument it has been replied that God might enable him to give such signs as should satisfy others that he is his messenger. But this answer, which seems to be perfectly rational, infidels are not disposed to admit, and they endeavor to evade it by various pretexts. Some of them argue as if miracles were impossible. If they mean that there is no power by which a miracle could be performed, we may close this controversy with them, because it is manifest that they are atheists in their hearts, whatever hypocritical professions that they may make of their belief in a deity. If they mean that God, having established the laws of nature, will never alter them, they assume a principle which they cannot support by a shadow of proof, and which we are at perfect liberty to deny. Is he bound by fate like the gods of heathenism, or has he bound himself by an immutable decree? What should hinder him from occasionally changing his ordinary mode of operation when some great purpose of his moral government will be accomplished by the change? Whether would wisdom be more displayed by pursuing a uniform course without any regard to new combinations of circumstances, or by deviating from it to meet the emergencies which might arise in the progress of events? Is it not worthwhile to spend time in refuting a gratuitous assumption? If it can be shown that a single alteration or suspension of the laws of nature ever took place, these profound speculations vanish into smoke. But some, who admit that miracles are possible, maintain that they are not sufficient to prove a revelation, upon this ground that there is no necessary connection between truth and power. We acknowledge that the power of man may be, and often has been, exerted in favor of falsehood. But what has this to do with the dispensations of an all-perfect being, in whose eyes truth is sacred, and of whom it would be blasphemous to suppose that lie would interpose to lead his creatures into error? But the infidel will perhaps tell us that this is not what he means. He suspects no intention in the deity to deceive, but he cannot place confidence in the fidelity of his messengers, or at least he has no assurance that they would honestly deliver their message and religiously abstain from adding to it or taking from it. They may alter it to serve a particular purpose, and may employ the miraculous power with which they are invested to give authority and currency to imposture. But surely, as God is thoroughly acquainted with the characters of men and foresees their future actions, we might assume it as certain that he would not commit a trust so important, so intimately connected with his own glory and the happiness of his creatures, to any person by whom he foresaw that it would be abused. The supposition of its abuse is a direct impeachment of the knowledge or the wisdom of God in the arrangement of his plan. Besides, no man who believes that God has power over his creatures, over their minds as well as their bodies, can doubt that he is able to exert, and would exert, a controlling influence upon his servants, which would prevent them from corrupting and suppress all desire to corrupt the revelation which they were appointed to deliver to the world. They would be thus far passive in his hands that they could not frustrate his design in selecting them. It is vain to tell us that men are voluntary agents, for while we admit this truth, we know that their freedom does not render them independent of their Maker, that by some mysterious link it is connected with the immutability of his counsel, and that their liberty is unimpaired at the moment when they are fulfilling what he had determined before to be done. But there is another consideration which still more clearly demonstrates the absurdity of the supposition that men may apply to a different purpose the miraculous powers which they are endowed in order to attest revelation. Infidels seem to suppose that a man may possess the power of working miracles in the same manner as he possesses the power of moving his arm, that by the gift of God it becomes inherent in him, and is as much subject to his will as any of his natural powers. But their ideas are totally erroneous. Even among Christians, there is perhaps an indistinctness of conception upon the subject, and they speak of the power of working miracles as if it were some divine virtue, residing in the person by whom it is exercised. But in this sense, the power of working miracles was never vested in any mere man. In every case, God was the worker of the miracles, and all that belonged to the prophet or apostle was to give the sign, or to pronounce the words which the miracle immediately followed. No person ever dreamed that when Moses stretched out his rod over the Red Sea, he exerted a power by which its waters were divided. The account given by himself accords with the suggestions of reason on the subject. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and its waters were divided. Exodus 14:21. The same remark may be made upon all other miracles, which were equally beyond the sphere of human ability. If this statement be correct, it follows that the case supposed is altogether imaginary. No man could abuse by the power of working miracles, because to speak strictly, no man ever possessed it. The power was in God and not in his servant. And could the servant wield the omnipotence of his Lord at his pleasure? No, he might give the usual sign or pronounce the usual words, but if it was his intention to deceive, no effect would have followed. This argument, therefore, against the possibility of a revelation is as destitute of force as the others. It is founded in a confusion of ideas, in a gross misapprehension of the subject, and will cause no difficulty to those who consider that men were merely the instruments of the miracles which God was pleased to work by his immediate power. Having shown that a revelation is possible, and pointed out the futility of the pretext by which a proposition so simple and obvious has been perplexed, I remark in the next place that it is desirable. In this sentiment, all will concur, but those who account religious truth a matter of absolute indifference, or who believe that reason is sufficient for all the discoveries which are necessary to guide men to virtue and happiness. Infidels adopt the latter principle, but at the same time give abundant evidence that they are influenced by the former. In no part of their conduct is there any indication of reverence for religious truth, and of a sincere desire to discover it, but they continually betray symptoms of levity and impiety, a contempt for seriousness, a disposition to cavil rather than to inquire, to muster up objections, to perplex evidence, to involve everything in doubt, and to turn the most solemn of all subjects into ridicule, so that it should seem that there is nothing which they are less eager to discover than truth, and that nothing would be so unwelcome as a clear and convincing manifestation of it. But whatever are the thoughts of men devoted to pleasure and living without God in the world, every person who feels that he is an accountable being must be desirous to know by what means he may fulfill the design of his existence and obtain the happiness of which his nature is capable. That a revelation is desirable is evident from what you heard in the preceding lecture. I there considered reason as a source of theology, and proved its insufficiency to give us satisfactory information respecting the doctrines of natural religion. It is proper in this place to take a short review of the observations which were made upon this subject. It appeared that the existence of one God, which is the fundamental principle of religion, is not discoverable by reason, or at least cannot be discovered by it with such clearness as to produce a firm, permanent, and practical conviction of it in the mind. Hence we find that not only did the people in all heathen nations fall into polytheism, and the grossest superstition, and the philosophers patronized by their example the errors of the vulgar, and if they sometimes spoke of one God in their writings, there was nothing like certainty and consistency in their opinions. Amidst their speculations, the idea occurred to them, but obscurity hung upon it, and to the wisest of them he remained an unknown God. It appeared also that their notions of his relation to man were exceedingly imperfect. None of them believed a proper creation, all holding the eternity of matter, and their views of providence, even when they approached nearest to the truth, were very different from those which we have learned from Revelation, as they maintained the doctrine of fate, to whose irresistible decrees the gods as well as men were compelled to bow. It appeared further that although they had made greater progress in the science of morality, the general precepts of which are suggested by conscience, by the relations subsisting among men, and by means of private and public utility, they were not able to deliver a perfect code of duty. In their best systems, there were great defects. Virtue was mistaken for vice, and vice for virtue. There were omissions which ought to have been supplied, and redundancies which ought to have been retrenched. Besides, their moral precepts wanted authority. In proportion as the sanctions of religion were imperfectly understood, their power over the heart was feeble. They were rather themes of declamation than rules of practice, and proved utterly insufficient to render the teachers themselves virtuous, and, as might be naturally expected, to restrain the torrent of licentiousness among the people. Lastly, it appeared that with respect to the immortality of the soul, the wisest men lived and died in doubt. In the popular creed, future rewards and punishments had a place, but they were treated with derision by those who boasted of a superior wisdom, partly on account of the ridiculous manner in which they were described by the poets, and partly because they rested upon no solid ground. They were reputed tales of the nursery, or the fictions of poets. The light of nature was too feeble to dispel the darkness which enveloped the world beyond the grave. A revelation was desirable, although it had gone no further than to solve those doubts, and to shed light upon the doctrines of natural religion. These were interesting to all, and engaged the particular attention of men of reflection. But the success of their inquiries by no means corresponded with the earnestness of their wishes. In these circumstances, would not revelation be acceptable, as is the rising of the sun to the bewildered traveler, who is anxiously seeking the road to the place of his destination, but cannot find it amidst the darkness of the night? There are several passages in the writings of the heathens which show that while they were sensible of their ignorance, they were persuaded that there was no remedy for it but in a divine interposition. The truth is, says Plato, speaking of future rewards and punishments, to determine or establish anything certain about these matters in the midst of so many doubts and disputations is the work of God only. Again, one of the speakers in his Phaedo says to Socrates concerning the immortality of the soul, I am of the same opinion with you, that in this life it is either absolutely impossible or extremely difficult to arrive at a clear knowledge of this matter. In his apology for Socrates, he puts these words into his mouth on the subject of the reformation of manners. You may pass the remainder of your days in sleep, or despair of finding out a sufficient expedient for this purpose, if God in his providence do not send you some other instruction. But the most remarkable passage is in the dialogue between Socrates and Alcibiades on the duties of religious worship. The design of this dialogue is to convince Alcibiades that men labor under so much ignorance that they should be exceedingly cautious in their addresses to the gods, and should content themselves with very general prayers, or what is better, not pray at all. To me, he says, it seems best to be quiet. It is necessary to wait till you learn how you ought to behave towards the gods and towards men. When, exclaims Alcibiades, when, O Socrates, shall that time be? And who will instruct me? For most willingly would I see this man who he is. He is one, replies Socrates, who cares for you. But as Homer represents Minerva as taking away darkness from the eye of Diomedes, that he might distinguish a god from a man, so it is necessary that he should first take away the darkness from your mind, and then bring near those things by which you shall know good and evil. Let him take away, rejoins Alcibiades, if he will, the darkness or any other thing, for I am prepared to decline none of those things which are commanded by him, whoever this man is, if I shall be made better. The passage is truly curious and deserves particular attention from us at this time, as a proof of the longings of nature for such a revelation as has been since given to the world. The wisest philosopher of antiquity acknowledged it to be necessary, and ventures to anticipate it without, however, knowing what he said. His disciple was transported at the thought, and professed his readiness to submit to the lessons of his teacher. It is only among the present race of unbelievers, the Socrates and Platos of modern times, as they would have us to account them, that the idea of a revelation is held up to ridicule, and the self-sufficiency of reason is maintained. What were the ideas of the heathens in general with respect to a revelation? We may infer from some parts of their religion. Their prayers were applications to the gods for direction and assistance in the conduct of affairs. Their priests and priestesses, whom they believed to be inspired, their omens and auguries, and their oracles which they consulted in cases of difficulty, were so many testimonies to the general conviction and the ignorant that the ignorance and infirmity of man rendered intercourse with beings of superior wisdom and power necessary to his welfare. It was thus that the defects of reason would be supplied. What man knew not, the gods could teach him, and it was chiefly to the temple of Apollo, the god of wisdom, that the Greeks and persons from other nations repaired to obtain the responses of the oracle in matters of public and private interest. Revelation would be desirable, even although reason were capable of discovering all the truths of natural religion. It would not follow upon that supposition that they were so obvious as to be discovered without any labor. The exercise of our mental powers would be necessary to collect the proofs of the existence and government of God, and to trace our duty in its manifold ramifications. There are no innate ideas in the human mind, no ideas with which we are born, and which we perceive intuitively as soon as reason begins to dawn. All our knowledge is derived from observation and experience. Hence, it is evident that a revelation would facilitate the acquisition of knowledge to all, and particularly to those whose intellectual faculties were originally not strong, and had not been improved by education, and whose daily occupations afforded them little leisure for inquiry and reflection. It cannot be denied that a great part of mankind labor under disadvantages for the discovery of truth, that they are apt to be misled by false opinions, and distracted by worldly cares, and to neglect those objects which require abstraction of mind and patient investigation. The infidel himself is compelled, by indisputable facts, to acknowledge that whatever power he ascribes to reason, it has generally failed to lead men to a rational system of religion, nay, that such a system was never established by its aid in any nation, or even in any school of philosophy. It is manifest, therefore, that if a revelation had been granted to point out at once the conclusions at which reason could have arrived only by a tedious process, it would have been an invaluable gift to the world. Upon this subject we can entertain no doubt. A revelation has been granted, and what is the consequence? The doctrines of natural religion are better understood than they were at any former period. They are known not only to men of studious and contemplative minds, but to the illiterate. We become acquainted with them at the outset of life, and there are thousands of young persons in a Christian country whose knowledge far exceeds that of the most distinguished heathen philosopher. They have learned by a few lessons more than he could acquire by the painful researches of a long life. We have proved, however, that reason is not sufficient to discover the truths of natural religion, and consequently that revelation was not only desirable, but necessary to deliver men from a state of ignorance at once shameful and perilous. And this necessity will be more apparent if we consider that they were not only ignorant, but guilty, fallen from innocence and happiness, condemned by the law of nature, a clearer discovery of which would have served only to impress more strongly on their minds a conviction of demerit, and to heighten the dread of their offended Creator. The republication of the law of nature would have done nothing to quiet their apprehensions and revive their hopes. On the contrary, it would have had the same effect as would take place in the case of a criminal, who, suspecting that he was doomed to punishment, should have the sentence of death put into his hands, distinctly written and authenticated by the signature of the judge. Still, he knows that his prince can reprieve him, but whether he will extend mercy to him, he cannot learn from the law which has condemned him, but by a new communication transmitted in a different channel. The situation of men in consequence of sin is like that of the criminal. The law under which they were made has pronounced sentence upon them. The lawgiver, according to the best conceptions which they can form of his character, is just and able to maintain the authority of his law. There is indeed a display of goodness and patience in his administration, but it is so intermixed with tokens of his wrath that the hope to which it may give rise is faint and fluctuating. And unbiased reason must come to this conclusion, that the guilty have everything to fear. If the lawgiver has any merciful design towards his rebellious subjects, it is a secret in his own breast, and all our speculations on the subject are conjectural and presumptuous. In the commencement of our course, while we have not yet proved that a revelation has been given, I cannot quote any parts of it as possessing more authority than belongs to the sayings of an ordinary man, which are agreeable to the dictates of reason and common sense. The following words of the Apostle of the Gentiles are brought forward merely as a just representation of the state of the case. Eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them to us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so the things of God knoweth no man, but the Spirit of God. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 9 through 11. As the thoughts of a man are known to none but himself, as he alone is conscious of them, and they remain concealed from others, unless he disclose them by external signs, so the counsels of God with respect to his fallen creatures are a mystery, hidden from every eye but his own, a secret which no sagacity could explore. And those counsels are so much above our conceptions, so different from anything which appears in creation and providence, that no idea of them would have ever occurred to the human mind in its loftiest excursions. It is evident, therefore, that a revelation is necessary for the information of man, in the new circumstances in which he was placed. He wanted to know whether the deity was placable, whether he was disposed to exercise clemency to offenders, upon what terms he would receive them into favor, and by what expedient he would adjust the claims of mercy and justice. Who does not see that in reference to points so interesting, but so obscure, none could give him satisfaction but God himself? If a revelation had not been granted, there would not have been any religion in the world. What natural religion actually is, you will learn not from the factious systems of Christian writers, but from its state among heathen nations. And although it is hardly worthy to be accounted religion, yet if you are disposed to give it this name, remember that any portion of truth which it contains is not derived from unassisted reason, but from tradition, and that it is probably owing to this cause that it has not become utterly extinct. Revelation is indisputably the sole origin of the religion which we profess. Without it, we should have been profoundly ignorant of the Savior in whom we believe, and of the promises which are the ground of our hope. I have endeavored to show that a revelation is possible and desirable, and proceeding a step farther have affirmed that it is necessary. This necessity arises from the ignorance of mankind respecting points of the greatest importance, which could be remedied by no other means. It was necessary that light should be thrown upon those primary truths in which we conceive man to have been at first instructed by his Maker, but which his dim-sighted reason could no longer discern in their original purity and beauty, and that new discoveries should be made to him, adapted to the exigencies of the new situation in which he had been placed by his apostasy from God. This general view of the design of revelation leads me to inquire what, upon a calm and unbiased view of the subject, we might previously expect to be its nature and character. First, we might expect it to contain all the information which man wants as a moral and accountable being. We cannot perceive any design with which it would be given, but to communicate to us the knowledge of God, and of our duty to him, and to point out the means of regaining his favor and rising to perfection and felicity. Proceeding as it does, according to the hypothesis from the fountain of wisdom and goodness, it must be perfect, like his other works. That is, it must be fitted to answer its end. Neither defect nor redundance would be consistent with the character of its author. But remember that its end is religion, and that if it accomplish this end, it is worthy of God, although there should be many other ends, and these two of importance to mankind, to which it is not adapted. There is much knowledge which is useful and necessary to us in the present life, but which it would be unreasonable to expect that a divine revelation should teach us. There is the knowledge of the arts, by which human life is sustained and cheered and adorned, and the knowledge of the sciences, which not only gratify curiosity, but lend their aid to improve the arts, and promote in various ways our temporal interests. But revelation says nothing about them, because they are not connected with its main design, and here reason is perfectly sufficient. There are also many questions relative to the nature of God and our own, the constitution of the universe, the phenomena of the moral world, and a future state of existence, of which it would gratify us much to obtain a satisfactory solution. And to some idle speculatists, information concerning them would be more acceptable than communications of unspeakably greater importance. But these questions have nothing to do with our duty, and although they were all answered to our complete satisfaction, they would make us neither wiser nor better. They would not relieve a guilty conscience or console an afflicted heart. It is for purposes of greater moment that the God of heaven will deviate from his usual course. It is to send down some rays of celestial light to our benighted world, to show us the path to glory and immortality. Secondly, we might expect a revelation to deliver its instructions rather in an authoritative than in an argumentative manner. The argumentative manner is proper when we are addressed by men who have no title to be heard, unless they give reasons for what they say, or content themselves with the idle labor of repeating self-evident propositions. The authoritative manner has been sometimes adopted by certain professed teachers of wisdom, but they had to deal with a very credulous audience, or they had contrived previously to establish a belief of their superior attainments. Pythagoras enjoined silence upon his disciples for a certain number of years during which they were to give an implicit assent, and autas effe, he said it, passed current among them as sufficient authority. But whatever blind submission there be among mankind to the dictates of others, it is generally reprobated as unworthy of our rational nature. It is demanded of him who pretends to teach others that he should prove what he affirms, because it is evidence only which can produce rational conviction, and no man has a right to call upon others to follow him unless he can show them that the way is safe. But a different procedure is suitable to a divine revelation. It comes from the source of wisdom, who is not liable to err, and can have no intention to deceive us from the author of our being, who has a right to require that we should serve him with the submission of our understandings, as well as with the love of our hearts. Revelation is not a counsel, but a law. It is not proposed as a subject of deliberation which may be accepted or rejected according to the result, but it is a declaration of the will of the Supreme Lord, which all to whom it is published are bound to obey. Nothing would be more unjust than to object against a revelation, because it was propounded in a tone of authority. The objection, however, was made when the Christian revelation was promulgated, and we find Celsus, who expressed the sentiments of other philosophers, exclaiming against our religion and its ministers, because instead of reasoning with men, they required them to believe. The objection would have been well founded if, without producing any proof of the divine origin of the gospel, they had insisted that men should believe it. But after the evidence had been exhibited, they acted in character when, speaking in the name of God, they commanded their hearers to acquiesce in the dictates of his wisdom, without murmuring and disputing. If in this stage of the business I may be allowed to appeal to the revelation which has been given to the world, it will be found that although reasoning is employed on particular occasions, upon the whole it is delivered in an authoritative form. There is a striking example at the beginning of it, for the account of the creation is not supported by a single argument, but is delivered in a simple narrative, to be received upon the authority of the writer, or rather of God, by whom he was inspired. Lastly, we may expect that there would be some difficulties in a divine revelation. At first it might seem that difficulties would be inconsistent with its design, which is, as the word imports, to discover what is unknown, and to illuminate what is obscure. But a little reflection would convince us that even here perfect light is not to be looked for. Such a degree might be reasonably expected, as should fully assure us of the great doctrines and duties of religion, but not so much as to give us complete satisfaction respecting all the points of which we might wish to be informed. Revelation speaks of the things of God, and how could they be made plain to our understandings? Language, being the vehicle of human thought, could not convey a distinct account of subjects which the human faculties are unable to comprehend. There are facts relative to the essence and the dispensations of the Almighty, which it may be necessary that we should know, because our duty may be intimately connected with them, but which it may be impossible to explain to us. Revelation demands faith, and pure faith is an act of the mind by which it assents to certain facts, or propositions upon the authority of testimony, without having any other evidence of their truth. Faith is therefore more perfect in proportion as the thing to be believed possesses less credibility in itself, and rests solely upon the veracity of the testifier. Hence we may conceive a great moral purpose to be served by the difficulties which are found in Revelation. Whether in some cases they might not have been avoided is a question which we are not competent to discuss. But they are so far from counteracting that they promote the design of Revelation, which is to make us not only wise, but good, to exercise our moral as well as our intellectual powers. Difficulties are a trial of man's dispositions. Like our Lord himself in the state of humiliation and suffering, who to some was precious, but to others a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They call for docility and humble submission to divine authority, and wherever these tempers are, revelation will be cordially received. But the men who are elated by the pride of science will not stoop to authority, and refuse to believe what they cannot comprehend. They must do as they have a mind. If, notwithstanding the luminous evidence with which revelation is attended, they will reject it because every part is not adjusted by the square and compass of reason, they only betray their own folly and presumption, and they must abide the consequences.